The Lucas County Council Podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County Council Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. More information at causakids.net.
Welcome to The Power of One, the Lucas County CASA podcast, where we explore how just one caring adult can make a life-changing difference for a child in the welfare system. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca. In today's episode, we discuss how CASA volunteers show up for the children we serve. I'm excited to welcome attorney Julie Jacek Bookmiller. She's a founding partner at Jacek Bookmiller Legal LLC, where she focuses her practice on family and child-related legal matters. With years of experience advocating for children and families, Julie brings both professional expertise and a deep personal commitment to ensuring every child's voice is heard. She has seen firsthand the difference a CASA volunteer makes in the courtroom and in a child's life. Julie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into the heart of today's discussion, let's take a moment to get to know Julie, her background, her career path, and what has fueled her passion for child welfare. Julie, could you start by sharing about your professional background and the type of legal work you do?
Sure. I actually am a former prosecutor for the city of Toledo. I worked in their domestic violence unit, so I was working with families in crisis even then. I've also been the public defender for the Adult Felony Drug Court, now known as the Treatment Court, in Lucas County with Judge Ian English, which was a wonderful experience, but again, working with families in crisis. And both of those situations, there was often a CSB case in the background, even though I wasn't directly involved. So it was interesting to kind of segue into this work. I have had my credentials with CASA for about a decade, and I've worked with up to 40 kids at a time during that time period, a lot of families over the last 10 years, and I really enjoy it. But this is the intersection of my criminal law practice and my juvenile law practice. I grew up here. I'm from here. So I went to the University of Toledo Law School. So this is definitely something I think is important for the community.
What drew you to the practice of family and child welfare law?
This is, like I said, where I'm from. So how my community is doing is directly impacted how families here are doing. I have a family here myself, and whom my children play with are the people that we serve. Mm-hmm. And it's important that every family out here is as healthy as we can get them to be.
Yeah. What is one of the most rewarding aspects of your work at Jacek Bookmiller Legal LLC?
I, like I said, work with families in crisis, so it is absolutely wonderful for me when I see the success stories, when I run into them out in the community, running a business, when I run into them out in the community working, when I get to see the graduations from high school, when I get to hear of our kids in college. Those are always the best, most rewarding parts for me, is the outcomes. That's really why I do it, although this is also how I feed my family.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice intersection. You can combine both your passion for community outreach and making a difference and providing for your family. So that's a great combination.
Yeah, it's kept me doing it for quite a while.
Yeah. Outside of the courtroom, what motivates you personally to stay engaged in this work?
Like I said, I'm raising a family here. While I avoid taking cases that I know my family knows the family of, I have had cases where my child has met the children subsequently. And that keeps me engaged, honestly, because those families are then healthy enough that I feel comfortable for my child being exposed to them. And I never have to disclose that there's a risk here. It's always wonderful. It's nice to wander around the community and know that people are doing better.
How did you first become familiar with CASA volunteers, and what stands out to you about the role they play?
I first became aware of the CASAs when I was in law school. They actually came and recruited at the University of Toledo. And I got my credentials before I got my law license. So I actually was a CASA volunteer, I believe, for two cases before I was able to be a guardian ad litem.
Okay.
I think that CASAs do add a lot because somebody actually sits down with the child and asks them what they want. There's a lot of bureaucracy in these cases. The Lucas County Children's Services, while not necessarily a negative force, is a bureaucracy. They have rules and regulations, and just like every other government entity. And what the kid wants and the kid's individual voice gets lost in that, especially with our teenagers. They have a voice, they have an opinion, and sometimes it's a really thought out one. And they're about to be young adults, and that voice impacts where they're going in the future and their near future. And I think it's valuable to get that heard in the courtroom.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's a group that we forget about, the teens, or nobody wants to realize, you know, those teens that live in foster care, they need the same support or maybe more support than the little ones, because they are, you know, they don't have that support system that the little, you know, children living in foster care might have through the family, you know, the foster family or people they have around, you know, in school. So we definitely need to pay more attention to this group. So thank you, you know, for sharing your story. And now I'd love to shift gears and discuss your perspective as an advocate. So particularly the ways CASA volunteers impact children and families within the child welfare system. You work with many children and families. What role do you see CASA volunteers playing in the child welfare system?
So the CASAs and the guardian ad litems, because I use them kind of interchangeably, because the only difference is that I'm a lawyer and I have to do my own paperwork, really, is that we show up in court and we get that child's voice heard. And sometimes that child's voice is going, hey, this auntie nobody heard about, I could live with them and they're wonderful. And sometimes we're bringing that perspective in, or that opportunity for a placement. A lot of the teens are in a situation where they're not going home. Reunification's not realistic for them. So sometimes looking for a non-foster placement, a supportive placement, may look like a play cousin, a street auntie, somebody who's not biologically related, but is still a kinship placement, somebody that child already trusts and already feels comfortable with, and we get to bring that. Also, kids will talk to us in a way they do not talk to a government entity. Families will talk to us in a way they will not talk to a government entity. There's a trust problem between the government and a lot of the communities that we serve.
Yeah.
Right, wrong, or indifferent, it's there.
Yeah.
And we come in and we are somebody from the community that just wants to listen and help make the situation better.
Mm-hmm.
And we sometimes pick up on those things like, this person over here is not safe, where they won't disclose it to the government because they don't want charges pressed and they don't want these other things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, maybe we shouldn't place that child in that home.
Mm-hmm.
And those are important things to bring to the court and to have backed up. Additionally, little kids especially will tell you all kinds of things if you sit there long enough.
Mm-hmm.
If you sit there and you color with them, they will tell you everybody's business. And those are the things we need to know to be able to make the safest decision for those families.
Yeah, and that's why our volunteers, usually the CASA volunteers, usually have one to two cases at the same time. Now, I know the GALs might have more. You probably have a lot more cases.
I do. I have an awful lot more cases than that. I have about 40 children currently, about 30-some cases, because I prefer to take singles.
Yeah, okay. And the reason why is because you do these full-time. So it's different than a CASA volunteer who has a full-time job and is doing these, you know, as an extra thing, you know, plus their family, you know, taking care of their families and stuff. So,
yeah, this is my full-time job.
Yeah.
So I would not be able to do a full-time job and adequately serve 30-some families.
From your perspective as an attorney, how does the presence of a CASA volunteer impact a case? Because you don't always represent the children, right?
That's
you can
true.
Also represent parents.
So
when you, let's say you're in a case where you're representing one of the parents, have you seen like a difference in regards to like the impact the CASA volunteer makes?
Yes. Now, okay. The reason I paused is I also work with teen moms, so they're an extra layer. But the CASA is very helpful when I'm representing a parent because they're doing an independent investigation. They're not just checking boxes. They're not from the agency. So they do have that unique perspective, which might help my client. It might be that my client really wants their sibling to be the one that gets custody of their children while they're going through the system. And they help, the CASA will help get that in front of the court, even if the agency is a little hesitant. They can have a difference of opinion. They do an independent investigation, and they have a different set of rules. So that can be very helpful for my clients. It can also be detrimental for my clients, depending on what's out there. But it does add that layer. Additionally, since I do frequently represent teen moms, having a CASA that is also talking to my teen mom adds a different perspective. The CASA is worried about my kid as a kid. I'm worried about my kid as a mom when I'm representing them as their attorney. And that is two arguably different things. It might not be in her best interest to be placed in the same home where her child is if her child is placed in a home that has been detrimental to her. But that home might be entirely safe for the baby. So having somebody who comes in who's able to come to the court with a different answer than I have, because there are two separate people involved, is also important.
Yeah. Wow, that's complicated.
It is, but yeah. I like the complicated ones.
Yeah. So in our last episode, we explored some of the challenges older youth face while living in foster care. And sadly, one of those challenges is the risk of being trafficked. So Julie, you work directly with children who are survivors of sex trafficking. What unique obstacles do these young people encounter in the legal system?
So my trafficking victims are often charged with or the victim of crimes. There are often felony cases going in the background, either in the delinquency level where they're charged against children, or at the felony level where they're charged against adults. My trafficked youth may even be youth in the system over the age of 18 and be charged as an adult themselves. There are different defenses available to trafficking victims for some of those crimes, but those are all really complicated extra layers that it adds in. There are also extra resources. We have a great organization called Advocating Opportunity locally that helps trafficking victims of all ages, not just sex trafficking, but also work trafficking of other types.
Okay.
That I work pretty closely with, that has other advocates and other support systems to help these young people who have been victims.
Okay. How can you be especially supportive of children who have experienced trafficking or exploitation?
It's important to kind of let them tell you what the boundaries are for how close you are.
Okay.
They need safe adults. They need adults that aren't asking anything of them, especially when it comes to touch. So I'm not offering them a hug. I'm not offering to touch them. I am not hugging them. If they want or look like they're crying or breaking down, I go, do you want a hug? It is always a question and offer, and they are always welcome to decline because they don't have a history of bodily autonomy. And that's something, it's hard to take a step back and go, oh, the child's crying, I want to touch it. Don't. Let the child decide if you're going to touch them. Same with, it is not a tit for tat in any conversation with me. You don't want to talk to me today. That's okay. I brought chips. You can have them anyway. Thanks for letting me see that you were physically okay today. I'll come back and I'll see you next time.
Okay.
Because their boundaries, they need to have the right to enforce.
And
that is different for our trafficking victims. Also, they have criminal ties. Whether we like it or not, some of their support network is criminal. Because that's who they know. That's who they've spent time with, and those people may be very, very important to them. So you have to be careful how you talk about them. I can't go, your pimp is a horrible human being. Because their pimp may have been the best adult to them in the last couple years. And honestly, he may not be a horrible human being outside of what he's doing to this child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There may be redeeming qualities. So if they tell you something positive, you can't immediately go, but we're not going to deal with him. We're never going to reunify with him. You're not allowed to talk to him. If you become reactive to it, they will shut down because that was their previously safe adults.
Yeah, yeah. And I know when I was getting ready for this episode, our CASA director, Chris Carrier, she mentioned that right now we only have GALs take these cases, so like trafficking victims. At some point, we want to train our volunteers, our CASA volunteers, to work with these teens. But as of right now, you know, because there are complicated cases, so, you know, we usually, you know, have GALs work with these children. But I just wanted to mention that. So, you know, if you're listening, I don't want you to be overwhelmed or scared to, you know, join us as a volunteer. But eventually we want to, you know, we want to train our volunteers because this is our reality. This is happening in our community. So,
yeah, there are definitely lots of baby cases. I just personally don't take them.
Yes. Yeah. You're yeah. Right.
I'm not trying to scare anybody off. There are lots of cases that are not this complicated. I personally seek out the complicated cases because I feel that that provides the most benefit with my educational and experience background for the kid.
Yes.
And I kind of like teens.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to scare anybody off.
Yeah. Well, and for the purpose of this episode, you know, to bring the attention to the teens, they need strong advocates like you. You know, they need a strong voice in court. So is there a story that stands out to you where you made a real difference for a trafficking survivor?
Absolutely. I'm not going to use any names. Mm-hmm. There was a child I was originally appointed as the guardian ad litem on a delinquency case, meaning she'd been charged with a crime. She had not been identified as a trafficking victim yet. During my investigation, she was identified as a trafficking victim, both by law enforcement and myself. A case was started where she was the victim. She was actually a runaway at one point during our case. She was found with her trafficker by law enforcement when they raided it and found multiple other teens. She was absolutely at risk. The whole thing was very scary. All the police reports were terrifying. She is now enrolled in a local college. Oh. She is in our Bridges program, which is another great support for our teens who are aging out of foster care. She did complete high school successfully. She completed medical treatment for some of her injuries and illnesses that she sustained while being trafficked. Mm. She participated in extensive mental health treatment, which is ongoing, which is a service that is being offered even while she's still in Bridges.
Okay.
And she's doing great. She's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Her attitude, her perspective, how healthy she looks, 100% different. And she was an angry, mad young lady when I met her.
Yeah.
The first time I met her, I gave her some hot talkies and she refused to talk to me. and I went, you know, you don't have to do anything for them. You can have them and I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I can see you or physically where I'm supposed to see you, and I'll be back next week. Showed up the next week with pizza, one of those hot and ready $5 pizzas.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, well, you're going to have to eat this pizza with me. and I sat there, and first 20 minutes, she just stared at me and ate her pizza.
Mm-hmm.
But after 20 minutes, she said I was all right. Now she calls me. She's aged out, so she no longer has to call me if she doesn't want to call me.
Yeah.
But she does. And it's really rewarding to see her doing so well because of how bad it was. She's the most traumatic story I've got. But I do actually have a boy I worked with who also ended up going to college and beating a pretty bad drug addiction. He also was trafficked, but it wasn't identified while he was a minor. He didn't disclose until he was an adult.
Oh, okay. Wow. What do you wish more people understood about the vulnerabilities of these children and the role community members can play in supporting them?
So the vulnerabilities, having stable, safe adults is not something every child has.
Mm-hmm.
It is really hard to watch a child try to find a stable, safe person. They will find it in a gang member. They will find it in a pimp. They will find it. And sometimes it's not a really safe person, but it's the best they got. Mm-hmm. That vulnerability is very real. I really wish people in the community would help families stay stable and safe when they see situations with housing instability, job instability, mental health instability, interacting early so that interventions can be minor and the family can stay together, mm-hmm. I think would be a dramatic help for these kids. Waiting until they're teens and it's been dramatic for so long is a whole lot of trauma to undo. And it can be really hard to impact those kids when there's only a couple years left in minority. Mm-hmm. And then we see that cycle repeat, which is really hard because then they don't have safe grandparents and they don't have those supports as an adult. And how are they going to offer those supports then as a parent? And that's very hard to watch.
Mm. Julie, can you help our audience understand what's the difference between the GAL and a CASA volunteer?
Sure. The CASAs are actual, what you think of as a pure volunteer. They are not getting paid for their services. They are, quote unquote, lay people. They are not lawyers. They're not usually a member of the Bar Association, although they can be. So they don't have that extra layer of being also governed by the Bar Association. We have some additional rules we have to honor for the Ohio Supreme Court as members of the Bar, and we do our own paperwork. The CASA volunteers have the benefits of the CASA office doing their report, paperwork, and motions, and some of their questioning in court. Lawyers, unfortunately, are expected to do that on their own, but we get paid for it. It is not at what you would think of as normal lawyer rates. It is at the appointed rate, which is governed by the Public Defender's Office. So it is significantly lower. It's closer to volunteer rates, but we can still make a living from it. So we does cover some of our overhead and those additional legal expenses that we incur doing the lawyer part of it. It's also something that the CASA office has relied on for the more complicated cases. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to their benefit. CASA office has, I believe, two lawyers on staff. They would have a very hard time going to the felony cases and the criminal cases and all of those other things that some of our more complicated cases have going on in the background.
Okay. So you, when you started with our program about 10 years ago, you were a CASA volunteer because you weren't an attorney yet, but you were in law school.
Correct. Right. So okay. I did actually take two cases as a CASA because I could not yet legally do my own paperwork. And so I was unpaid for those. So I have been a volunteer, but I do take most of my cases now paid, although I do volunteer my time. Mm-hmm. And some lawyers do take them as unpaid cases as well because of the complexity and the time requirements in the type of cases I personally take. I can't afford to do that, but I do volunteer a lot of time. For example, this will be unpaid.
Yeah.
and I do some mentorship situations also with other CASAs and guardian ad litems that are also unpaid. I do give back. It's just not as a full case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Julie, you have given us such a powerful look into the role CASA volunteers play, especially with children who have experienced tremendous challenges. In our next segment, we will spend some time talking about the power of showing up.
I'm Sharon Cook, and I'm a CASA volunteer, and I work with Children's Services in the juvenile court doing investigations into situations where children have been removed from the home. To be perfectly honest, I came from a home that if, when I was a child, they would have had all of these services, we should have gotten them. You know, I think the story would be watching these children blossom and advance, getting to know them, having them get to know me, and relate, and they just make my heart melt. I'm kind of paying it forward, being of service, making, you know, a small difference. I've seen it with the parents who are totally committed to changing and them having the courage to accept change and do what they needed to for their children, and hopefully put the beginning steps of breaking the cycle, the generational cycle, into place. I think that the CASA staff and the magistrates and the judges that I've worked with at juvenile court are the most extraordinary people that I have ever met.
Welcome back. Today we're talking about the incredible ways CASA volunteers and GALs show up for children. Attorney and CASA volunteer Julie Jacek Buchmiller joins me. Now, I'd like to turn our attention to the heart of this episode, our theme, the power of showing up. Julie, in your experience, what does showing up mean when it comes to advocating for children, especially those who have experienced trauma like sex trafficking?
So I think it is important to be there when you say you're going to be there. And I don't mean like 5 minutes late, that's forgivable, but that day, don't reschedule a bunch on these kids, because you want to be the stable adult. You want to show them what a stable adult looks like. And some of that's keeping your appointments with them. And they think that's important. Letting them know, I will be here next Wednesday. And then showing up next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Or acknowledging that. If you have their cell phone number, because a lot of our teens still have phones, you can go, I'm stuck in court. I'm going to be a half hour late. And respecting their time also is important. And they view that as showing up. I show up, and I'm going to be honest, I stop at Costco. I break the rules a little bit. And I bring a snack-sized bag of chips almost every time. I show up, but they can consistently expect they're going to get the bag of chips whether they talk to me or not. I'll show up, and even if they choose not to talk to me, I don't take it out on them. I will see you next time. And that's, especially for the more traumatized kids, mm-hmm. important. That even if they acted out today, even if they yelled at me today, I will show up again. Mm-hmm. And I won't hold last time against you. These kids need that. Mm-hmm. Also, I will show up in court. I will turn in the paperwork. I will do what you told me you needed done, or I'll explain to you why I'm not going to do it. They deserve to know that if I say I'm filing a piece of paper for you, that I'm filing a piece of paper. They deserve to know if I say, hey, I will follow up with your mom on that, that I do. That if you gave me a letter to give to your sibling when I visit them, that I will. Just being consistent for them is huge. And they seek that and they enjoy that, and that will help them open up.
Mm-hmm. As we mentioned earlier, CASA volunteers aren't attorneys or social workers, yet they play such a crucial role. Why do you think consistency and presence are so powerful in the life of trafficked survivors?
Because the only people who've been consistent with those trafficking survivors previously did not have their best interests in heart. They need people who don't want to take anything from them. I don't want anything from you. I'm going to take some of your time because it's required, but I'm not taking anything from you. You can't offer me anything. Don't gift me anything. I don't require you to do my hair. I don't need you to paint my nails. I don't want you to do anything. Nothing. Yeah. But I will show up. And for kids who've had only transactional relationships, that is very important. That modeling of an appropriate adult relationship is very important.
For potential volunteers listening, some may feel intimidated by the thought of working with children who've endured trauma. What would you say to reassure them about their ability to make a difference?
Okay. If you're a CASA volunteer, you're probably not getting these super complex cases. It's not the case you're going to get assigned first. CASA is pretty protective of its volunteers, and I think that that's wonderful. But even traumas that are less than trafficking, which, not that they're on a scale, but smaller traumas, are things that just being a decent adult in this child's life makes a difference. There used to be ads, I think Big Brothers, Big Sisters, that you don't have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. You just have to be there. And that actually has stuck with me years and years after, I'm sure, that ad ran, because it's true. The positive adults in my life weren't perfect, mm-hmm. but they were there. And they were consistent. And we can be that for these kids. We can help be one of the adults in their life, and we can help them find other adults that are like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been such an inspiring conversation. Before we wrap up, Julie, I'd love to give you the chance to share some final encouragement for our listeners, whether they're considering becoming CASA volunteers or simply looking for ways to support children in our community. What encouragement would you give the community members listening right now about stepping into advocating for children, whether as a CASA volunteer or in another supportive role?
So if you are a member of our community, you benefit by everyone in our community doing better. If you are a business owner here, you do better by everybody here being stable and employed. If you are a person with children in the community, you do better with their playmates, having stable, safe environments. All of those things are important, especially our kids, because if you're going to stay in this community, these kids are going to be the people who are working. These kids are going to be the next politicians. That's going to be important. Yeah. Let's make them stable and safe. Let's give them happy, healthy homes so that they have the best chance. Toledo will do better if we all work to make it be better. And I think we have a motto in Toledo that you will do better here.
Yeah.
So I think all of us kind of stepping up into that role will help that continue.
Mm-hmm. How can people connect with your work or learn more about the legal side of child welfare?
So I am on Facebook. I have an office next door to the juvenile court. Yeah, I am at Jacek Bookmiller Legal LLC. Jacek is J-A-C-E-K. And Bookmiller is like what you read, B-O-O-K-M-I-L-L-E-R. And I do mentorship and advocacy work, both with lawyers and with new CASAs and people who are interested. So if you reach out and want to get in touch with my office, I am happy to schedule time to go over the options, even if you choose not CASA, the other options to work with families and community in Toledo, because I do think it is so important for us to all kind of do our part with what we have to offer. And it may not be that you're good with kids.
Yeah.
You may have something else that's to your benefit. Maybe you're a small business owner and you can offer haircuts for kids in foster care.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's something small like that that seems small to you is huge to a kid starting school out of a foster home.
Yes. Yeah. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today and for reminding us of the courage it takes to stand beside a child who's walking through some of life's hardest moments. What you have shared is a powerful reminder that advocacy isn't about having all the answers. It's about presence, compassion, and commitment. To our listeners, children in our community are waiting for someone to step forward, someone willing to show up and say, "You matter. Your voice matters. Your future matters." That someone could be you. If you feel called to be that powerful, trusted presence in a child's life, I encourage you to learn more about becoming a CASA volunteer. Visit CASAKids.net or call 419-213-6753 to take the first step. Every child deserves a champion. Every child deserves to be seen and heard. And together we can make sure no child has to walk this journey alone. Thank you for tuning into the Lucas County CASA podcast, The Power of One. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca. Until next time, let's keep showing up for our children, for our community, and for hope.
The Lucas County CASA podcast highlights how the power of one person can transform the lives of abused children in our community. This podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County CASA program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. All episodes are posted on WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA program at CASAKids.net.